Shrink Wrap Radio number 353, Thriving with Adult ADHD, with Craig Suhrman, MD.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Harvard psychiatrist Craig Suhrman, MD, and we'll be discussing his work and writing in connection with adult ADHD. Dr. Craig Suhrman, co-author of Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might, is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the scientific coordinator of the Adult ADHD Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, which has helped develop several current treatments for ADHD that are widely in use. Dr. Suhrman has directed or facilitated more than 40 studies related to ADHD in adults. His work has demonstrated the broad impact of ADHD on daily life, including its effect on sleep, eating patterns, and emotions. He has studied several treatments for ADHD with his colleagues at Massachusetts General Hospital, including medication, cognitive behavioral therapy, and nutritional supplement interventions. He teaches courses on management of ADHD and presents his research nationally and internationally. Dr. Suhrman recently organized an international collaboration to educate clinicians on best treatments for adult ADHD, which will result in a book titled A Practical Guide to the Management of ADHD in Adults that will be published in spring 2013. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Craig Suhrman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, I have to say congratulations on your new book, Fast Minds. And you're a psychiatrist specializing in ADHD. How did you get involved with that particular specialty?
So I trained in neuropsychiatry as well as psychiatry. I was fascinated by brain circuits and brain function, and in particular, attention. I mean, on the wards, the idea that all it took was your urinary tract infection for a brain to be unable to focus.
Wow.
You know, that, like you see in delirium, was just fascinating to me. And there's just sensitivity of that circuit. And I think it became opportune that people were starting to understand that ADHD existed in adults. I think that I had always had a passion for organizational challenges, the issue of how do people organize their lives, and certainly always could improve my own organizational abilities. And so I think it was fortuitous that I started having conversations with people who were pushing the envelope at the time and sort of thinking about, you know, gee, these kids that grow up with ADHD, what happens to them?
Yeah, really. Fascinating that you started off with an interest in attention. My own doctoral research involved attention, but it was way before we had all these tools for really monitoring what's going on in the brain.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, most of us think of children when we hear the term ADHD, as you've just suggested, and you specialize in adult ADHD. I gather it's only fairly recently that attention has turned to adults with this diagnosis. What can you tell us about that?
Well, one of my supervisors is Paul Wender, who did a lot of work in Utah and wrote a book in the 70s on adult ADHD. And people have been talking about it in adults for a long time, but the opportunity for systematic research, I think, has only been there in the last 15 to, you know, or so years. People have had to go through a process of kind of proving what many people already knew, which is that, you know, about half of folks still have struggles in adulthood that have something to do with ADHD. One of the problems is that often they're struggles with focus as opposed to outward things like restlessness, impulsive action, that everyone can kind of just say, hey, that person's different from the outside.
Mm-hmm. I think it used to be thought that children with ADHD would eventually grow out of it. To what extent is this or is this not the case?
Well, impulsivity and hyperactivity tend to improve. I always say that it's unusual for me to have an adult, you know, pacing around the waiting room. And if they're climbing on the chairs and they're an adult, I'm going to have to call security. But if it's potentially, but if it's a child, that could just be normal. And so there's a motor control development. There's also development of just sort of social expectation and being able to anticipate that. So we definitely tend to see more inattentive type challenges than impulsive hyperactive. And it's, you know, clear that, you know, about half of folks persist in having these challenges. And that's been shown in international studies and longitudinal follow-up studies, multiple of them actually, that go out at least 20 years.
Yeah. Well, do any people sort of grow out of it, in fact, or not as children?
Well, yes. Yes. But it's unusual to eliminate all the traits. And I think a lot of people grow out of the condition in the sense that they're not impaired by it anymore. I always really take great pains to explain that there's a difference between having ADHD and being impaired by ADHD traits and just having the traits. These traits are very common in the human population. And people can find circumstances that are very favorable for them and for their traits. You don't get much choice about that when you're sitting in a row of chairs or if you're sitting in a cubicle at a job that just is asking of you things that are not natural. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have opportunities to outsource things that are a challenge for you to someone else, to find an environment which has the right kind of wiggle room and the right kind of structure, I think people end up not needing as much support.
I don't know if you have any statistics at the top of mind, but what can you tell us about how pervasive ADHD is in adults?
It's 4.4% of the adult population based upon the National Comorbidity Survey. And there's been, you know, for example, a study that looked at multiple countries, about 9 countries, and found the rate ranged anywhere from a high 2% to about somewhere in the 5s. And so this, you know, 3 to 4%, you know, is probably very reasonable. But I always make pains to say that there's a difference between surveys, which ask people, do they have a condition, and people who would actually choose to, for example, change their brains on a medicine, you know, for that condition. And I think that what really comes down to is, does an individual have this, you know, more than, you know, where do you fall on some sort of statistical assessment of, you know, how many of these traits you have? Because the issue of impairment is so individual. Like I said, some people are really able to adapt. And but the international studies really suggest that the rates are somewhere around, you know, 3 to 4% in adulthood.
So from what you've said, I take it that the symptoms present differently in adults than in children. And in children, they're more behavioral and you can kind of see it outwardly, but that in adults, it's more of a inward difficulty with controlling attention. Is that right?
And yes, it is. But there are many folks we work with who have a restlessness. And if you ask them what they were like as a kid, many of them were hyperactive. And the quality of sort of internal drive, needing to do something all the time, being bored easily, having trouble when you're at loose ends, kind of this is unstructured time and people get kind of like even emotional or uncomfortable. There's a sense that there's sort of an internal pace. And I'll use the sort of idea of, you know, being, you know, too charged and too revved. So it's an internal restlessness that someone will be having sitting at a conference table trying to participate and during a slow part of a meeting. Whereas when they were a child, they might have just been out of their seat and, you know, walking around. And
okay. Boy, it's hard for me not to have medical student syndrome here and see myself in what you're saying. And maybe it does fit. And we'll get into those traits in a bit.
Well, it may fit a lot of people. I mean, the problem is that these are very human traits. And the question is, do you have enough of them that, you know, that it's a burden?
Yes, right. Well, what about gender differences in how the symptoms present and also in the rates among adults?
So the gender difference is an interesting issue, and it's really prompted, I think, recently by recognition that the rate of identification in girls is up to like 1 in 9, you know, compared to boys. So 9 times as many boys being identified as girls. Usually the studies come out a little lower than that, like 4 times as many. But in adulthood, you see about 50-50, as many women showing up as men. And so the question is, what gives? And I don't think we've got a great answer about why there probably is, and many people agree with this, under-identification of girls. But one reason, I think, is that we've been talking about these outward manifestations, this sort of restlessness. And boys tend to be more physical, more outwardly active, and so they stick out. Also, we tend to see rule breaking a little more in boys than in girls with ADHD. And so there is this question of fitting in and pleasing the teacher, for example, if you think about a classroom example, might just be a gender difference. There are many women that I work with who say that they were quietly inattentive, sort of passing notes in the back of the classroom, but pulling it off and not really engaging. And now that's just not cutting it when they're an adult.
Yeah. Well, referring to adult women, are there any special challenges in relation to women with ADHD as opposed to, say, working with men?
I think it's very tempting to stereotype, but I think actually everybody has their own version of this. We're talking about a challenge with self-regulation, and so what is hard to sort of regulate, what's hard to control, depends upon who you are, what your challenges are, what your strengths are. I think there are. To stereotype, on the other hand, some concerns that women have that men tend not to have as much. And so you'll, because of their role and how they're cast in society, and this of course is changing, but for example, with that, all that caveat, I will say that you do see women coming in worried about their household duties, and really feeling that they're not on top of the household, and they may never have come in if it wasn't for a sense that it's impacting their children. Uh-huh. And they're worried that they're not on top of things for their kids.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I'm under the impression that DSM-5 has been revised to recognize adult ADHD. What are the changes in this regard in the DSM-5?
Well, there's specific wording for the symptoms of ADHD in adults. There's also relaxation of the number of symptoms that you have to currently have manifest. It's 6 of the inattentive or 6 of the impulsive hyperactive traits. And so that's dropped down to 5 now. And there's this challenge with identifying age of onset with adults. You know, you didn't see them as a kid, usually, unless you're like a long-term family practitioner, in their life. So when did it start? And it's a neurodevelopmental disorder. And that's actually another distinction that's being made, that it's neurodevelopmental as opposed to quote unquote disruptive. But the onset by 12, studies suggest, is pretty much about the same impact as onset by 7 in terms of how people's lives are now. So I think we'll see in May when DSM-5 comes out, onset by 12, 5 current symptoms instead of 6, specific examples of how the symptoms show up in adults, and the fact that it's going to be listed as a neurodevelopmental disorder.
Okay. Now, by the way, I just read something online to the effect that the National Institutes of Mental Health in the United States, NIMH, will no longer be using the DSM in the research that they fund. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, sure. And I think this has been an issue for a couple of years. The NIH has felt that part of their agenda should be to improve treatments in ways that are thought to be brain targeted. Mm-hmm. And the question has been, to what degree are our diagnostic categories truly reflective of unique brain properties? And there's a real problem when we've got kids and adults who meet for up to six or even more conditions at once. And this is certainly not the norm of people who come into a psychiatric clinic, but you certainly see people who would meet for major depression and anxiety, you know, as well as ADHD and maybe OCD and like social phobia. You know, they can have all these things all together. So there's been a move to try to have some way of identifying new targets for treatments other than these diagnostic categories, which may not really be pointing to the brain difference, but a manifestation of multiple brain differences, for example. So the NIH statement, some people have seen as undermining the DSM. I actually can't see it that way. I see it as a difference between a clinical agenda and a research agenda. Mm-hmm. The research agenda is in part to improve our diagnostic process and improve our treatments. And we've had years of working with the DSM constructs in one form or another, and we know where we're at with that. We still have many of the same kind of challenges about how to treat people.
Okay, well, that's a fascinating distinction between the research agenda and the clinical agenda. And I guess
to follow up on that, what they are emphasizing, what Tom Finsel was emphasizing in his statement about this, is that there's an idea that you can look at dimensions of function. For example, you know, control of focus, or attention control would be one dimension. Control over how you express your emotion might be another. Ability to self-soothe, for example, and get out of a mood state might be a different dimension of function. And so the idea is that there's some kind of dimensional way of looking at sort of the challenges people have that cuts across conditions. So problems, getting out of a mood state or getting out of one state of mind into another, this would be very important in many different conditions.
Yeah, and this makes me think of things like meditation, when you talk about the ability to control one's attention.
Sure.
Or to self-soothe. So this kind of suggests possible complementary medicine approaches.
Well, there's NIH has a whole complementary medicine division, and there's been great interest in, these sort of active mind sort of effort, sort of trainings and tasks that people will try, in that regard, and doing imaging and trying to see, okay, what are these people actually doing with their brains?
Right. Now, the title of your book is Fast Minds, and it turns out to be a bit of play on words, because not only are the words fast minds reflective of ADHD, but the letters in fast minds are an acronym. So maybe you can take us through that, if you will.
Sure. So F is forgetful. A is achieving low potential. S is stuck in a rut. T is time challenged. M is motivationally challenged. I is impulsive. N is novelty seeking. D is distractible. And S is scattered. And, we could have chosen different, words, but the Fast Minds acronym comes from my colleague, Dr. Bilkey in Canada, and his work to make physicians more aware about how ADHD manifests in people's lives. And what I really appreciated about the acronym, and we tweaked it a bit to fit, is that it evokes what it's like to live with ADHD. The classic sort of symptoms of ADHD tend to read something like misplaces things, often forgetful, trouble completing tasks, trouble getting around to tasks. And so it does offer sort of a more elemental exploration of what it's like to function in moment by moment. But the bigger picture for folks with ADHD is usually some version of these other kinds of challenges of, forgetfulness and feeling scattered and distractible or novelty seeking. And we find that people kind of hear themselves in the acronym. Now, it doesn't take much of these traits or life patterns to have a significant burden, however. You know, really don't want people to think that, you know, gosh, I have to have all of these. Really, any one or two of them, it's probably worth looking into the kind of resources that have been developed to help people who have these challenges.
Well, definitely all those are traits that many people can identify with, including myself. How can a person figure out if they really are ADHD or not?
So I think that should be ideally a clinical encounter where someone's bringing, has done some homework on, you know, the traits, has, you know, explored them and thought thoughtfully about how far back does this, you know, fit in my life? Does this explain me? And I think more importantly than that, does it matter? I mean, there are folks who have a certain style. Being very aware of things around them, for example, is different than being so distracted that you can't do things that are important to you. And so, you know, our book, and there's many other books like this, are looking at CHADD, which is an organization I'm a part of, chadd.org. Lots of resources for exploring these traits. And then having a conversation with somebody that, you know, who knows a lot about it, like a clinician, psychiatrist, neurologist who's interested in ADHD, or a psychologist, it could be anybody really who gets this, about, okay, to what extent does this explain me? And one of the things that I think is challenging is that there's lots of things that can make people feel scattered. And so the question is it me? And is it, you know, an ADD part of me, or is it another part of me? Is it that I've got a fair amount of anxiety and it's actually very hard for me to be effective socially, and a lot of my job is like that, and I really feel overwhelmed, for example? I mean, there's lots of different ways that people can end up, you know, sort of in this ballpark.
And I would guess, too, that part of what would be behind your writing this book is to help people engage in some degree of self-assessment.
Exactly. And we also wanted to empower people with just, you know, good evidence-based information wherever possible, and, like, you know, clinical expertise-based information, you know, for the rest of the content, about, you know, what do people who have these kinds of challenges do to thrive in life? And some of that is sort of, you know, is medical, but that's only one chapter of the book about medicine. The rest is about really dialing down and understanding one's patterns and coming up with, you know, ideally a minimum set of sort of strategies or habits that's going to make things easier.
Is there a relationship between ADHD and other mental health conditions like anxiety and depression?
Absolutely, and it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in ADHD. It's the first condition typically that's diagnosed in the lifespan. But you see higher rates of pretty much every psychiatric condition except for psychotic and obsessive compulsive, major depression, anxiety. There are different versions of anxiety, substance use risk. And we don't know whether that's because of shared common neurobiology or neurologic factors. But it is clear that there's, you know, a real burden of being different in a way that, you know, saps your self-esteem and makes you feel, potentially think negative things about yourself. Why can't I pull this off? Why can't I follow through? Everyone else is able to do this. What's wrong with me? So there's a dismay factor that's in there as well. But many people think that there probably are common genetic, or neurobiologic reasons that these conditions come together.
Yeah, and I think you also point out that ADHD can have an impact on sleep and eating patterns and emotions. What can you tell us about that?
So ADHD is sort of the only place in our diagnostic category that is one of the most well-known diagnoses that has something to do with life organization and how you organize your day. There are many people with attention deficit where it's much more about restlessness or much more about focus challenges. But a good portion, and it's at least 30% of folks with ADHD that we see at our institution, end up talking about organizational challenges, problems with planning, prioritizing, sense of time, And there's something very different between being able to focus on something or versus focusing on the right thing at the right time. And I'm always fascinated in my line of work that you see different patterns in different people. But you know, I have some people, for example, who are super organized at their job but not at home. I have patients who are accountants and other people rely on them to organize. I have patients who teach even organizational seminars to other people. This is not about a lack of skill, and it's also sometimes not about not being at all able to be on top of life patterns. Instead, it seems to be that there are certain circumstances and situations where a person just can't do it on their own. And so that can show up a number of ways. But in the book, we really highlight the sort of self-care impact this can have. You'll see people who are night owls and go to bed too late and has repercussions the next day. People who don't eat all day and then, you know, binge at night. People whose even emotional expression seems to be poorly controlled. And you wonder why that reaction was so strong. That seems out of left field. But it's not a mood disorder, and it's not, you know, exactly oppositional defiant disorder either. And so there's different patterns of these sort of self-regulatory issues that are very interesting to study in this population.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that there's only one chapter in the book devoted to medication.
Right, right.
And certainly we've all heard about Ritalin for kids. What is the role of medication in ADHD, particularly with adults? How effective is it? Does it cure it? Those kinds of issues.
So the medications that help ADHD all increase norepinephrine and dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, probably by blocking reuptake of basically neurotransmitters. And this is thought to sort of waken up parts of the brain that allow you to compensate for ADHD challenges. The actual sort of cause of ADHD is different probably in different people. You see different brain regions in different folks. It's not thought that the medicine is somehow correcting brain differences. Instead, it probably wakes up parts of the brain that allows people to compensate. So attention deficit medicines that work for children, we now know, also work for adults, especially the stimulant agents. And for a long time, it was thought that perhaps attention deficit in adults wasn't as treatable. And one of the main things that people had to do is do studies where they actually dosed appropriate to adults, because the stimulants to some degree distribute to the whole body. And so it was probably a matter of people just not giving high enough doses. And now we actually have multiple stimulants that are approved for use in adults, some non-stimulants, which may have a little more antidepressant kind of properties that people will also use, but many of which are off-label.
Okay. And are there important non-medication treatments that can help a person with ADHD?
So the core difference in ADHD, if it's one of focus, being able to follow through, complete things, is going to be what it is for boring or challenging circumstances in particular. However, organizational challenges, there's a lot you can do. You can absolutely sort of help people stack the deck in their favor so that they're more likely to be able to, follow through on things in life the way they want to. And one way I think about this is with people is that there's certainly places in life where people have thrived better than in others. And sometimes it has to do with the structure. You know, I did well when I did a group project, for example, and had to sit and, work with a team and I had a deadline. But gosh, now I'm trying to do graphic design and I've got this email and it's not clear that there's a deadline. But the more I do, the more money I make. But, it's all on me, and it's just me sitting in a cubicle and no one's meeting with me about this. So these are very different structures. And so one of the things we think about a lot with people is what can they do In terms of the right internal structure. Another major principle, and this is how the book is organized, is sort of like we hear people's stories and hear what principles help them, is that if there's something on the mind that's an internal distraction, to try to get it off the mind. And it's a very common phenomenon that while people are trying to work or talk or read or whatever, if they have ADD, that things just pop up like popcorn in their mind. I've got to get the dry cleaning, or my goodness, I forgot to order another set of stationery, or whatever. It could be random. And that's very ADD. And so, getting it out of the mind and writing it down was one of the behavioral therapy techniques that, from our cognitive behavioral therapy studies, that people really like the most, because they said, gosh, I just get it out of my head, and then I know it's out of my head. It reduces the anxiety about it. And then another piece of this is to have some time when people are actually going to manage this stuff that's in their head. And so having like a planning time. So you're already hearing that I'm talking about habits of actively trying to manage the environment, actively manage the thoughts that are popping up in the head, trying to be proactive. Well, a lot of the folks we work with have a really hard time with the new habits. They tend to live a life of doing what they have to do, what people make them do, versus being proactive. So how do you do that? And I think that's a lot of the work sometimes, is helping people understand what holds them accountable. I mean, to use the metaphor of going to the gym, if you've got a friend who comes to pick you up in their car and you got to be ready, and you're expected to go together, it's very different, for example, than just you could go anytime and maybe you're not going to go. So there are different sort of scenarios that people can try to cultivate that make it more likely for them to adopt new habits. And, there's a real role, I think, for mental health professionals in helping people identify the habits that are going to help them the most with their executive challenges, and then also playing a role of accountability and helping build in accountability.
One of the things that strikes me as I listen to you talk about this is that a lot of the issues sound very similar to issues with aging, that the difficulties people have with memory and distractibility.
So it's interesting. So with memory, over time, you tend to have some loss of long-term memory, more so than trouble with short-term memory. In attention deficit disorder, you see different patterns of neuropsychological function. Some people have absolutely fine sort of short-term memory, kind of the RAM on a computer, just like the things that have to be held in mind in the moment, like the sentence that you're composing right now is being held in sort of, in memory, or as you're hearing what I'm saying, that's being held in working memory as it's being understood. So the short-term or working kind of memory isn't always impaired, but with that caveat, I'll say that it definitely produces an ADD-type pattern when people have a very hard time holding very much in their working memory, because they can only kind of grasp onto part of everything. And there is a way in which, people who are starting to have memory problems as they get older will come in and they'll say, gosh, could this be ADD? That you can sort of tell if it is or isn't. And that's really understanding the life course. Ever since you were little, did you have problems with? And sometimes what you'll hear is that it's mostly about memory. And the most concerning thing, of course, is if people really have forgotten key elements of things that they should know from the long term.
I want to step back a couple notches here to where you were talking about what's going on in the brain. And I know I've heard this explained in the past, but I've forgotten the relationship. It seems paradoxical that stimulants are used, like Ritalin and so on, that these are kind of, they call it speed for somebody who's already, quote, speedy. And so explain that paradox to us, if you will.
Well, so stimulants, I don't think, are named very well. I mean, these are sympathomimetic. I think that's a better way to put it. So meaning that they their effects mimic the effects of the sympathetic nervous system. And in fact, they augment the effect of the sympathetic nervous system, in the brain. They also sometimes will impact the peripheral nervous system. So it's not, targeted just to the brain. You also get sort of physical symptoms of sympathetic increase. And the sympathetic nervous system is this system that's, you know, really useful if you see a tiger, enter your field of vision and might be about to attack you, blood's diverted to the periphery, you're ready for fight or flight, heart rate's up, and you're really focused on the tiger. And, the focus is what we want here. We don't want the rest of it, but we tend to get it sometimes, and it's quirky. So you'll have some people who have very strong heart rate and blood pressure increases on stimulants, and other people that don't. Now, stimulants also impact the dopamine system in the brain, not just the norepinephrine sympathetic system. And that dopamine system definitely has a lot to do with mood. And so if you give someone a stimulant quickly, a lot of it quickly to the brain, you end up with quite a surge of dopamine. And cocaine has the same kind of effect. However, stimulants linger longer. Cocaine hits the dopamine transporter that recycles dopamine, for example, and is right off it, whereas the stimulant is on it for a while and lingers. And so there's a way in which how much these agents linger at these transporters impacts how much of a dopamine surge people get, and also how much they're left craving it and wanting it again. So there's this complex neurophysiology and neurobiology, but the bottom line is that the stimulants give people more sort of alert, awake tone, and that's just what you want in someone with attention deficit. It's waking up the control centers of the brain. That someone who doesn't have attention deficit might still get the same benefit, but if you take too much of a stimulant, or if it's really just not the right drug for your brain for whatever reason, people can get euphoria, can get giddy, can get revved, any number of sort of effects like this.
Now, this is a bit of a diversion, but what about Adderall? You know, we keep reading in the press that students and even professors are taking Adderall for the boost in concentration that they seem to get. What can you tell us about this as a social issue? And
so Adderall and Ritalin are both stimulants, and there's non-stimulants which have cognitive effects as well. There's a huge issue of misuse of agents for non-medical purposes. There's also a percentage of people who are probably self-medicating, but perhaps would do better to go to a doctor as opposed to taking matters into their own hands. There's a very, very big concern that I have that, people can sort of enhance their ability to focus, but they're not necessarily doing anything to their ability to learn per se, how to adapt in life. This idea that people are taking stimulants just to make the grade, I think is a tragedy, and I want to be very clear about that. And, at the same time, there's a sort of a gross generalization, I think, that these drugs are bad or a problem, and I see them as just like any tool that humans tend to create. A knife could cut you really badly if you don't know how to use it, or if it's in the wrong hands, and it's sort of the same kind of thing with these meds. One of the things that I work on is nutraceutical or sort of medical food interventions for ADHD, and also some non-stimulant interventions for ADHD that our group has helped work on and develop. And one of the main reasons is that we want agents that are less divertible for recreational or frank abuse purposes. If you have a drug that tweaks dopamine, you can end up in a situation where you like taking it if you've taken too much or you get it too quickly. So the shorter acting versions of these drugs, for example, maybe crushed or snorted, therefore have a higher street value typically than the longer acting versions. And, where there's a problem with all the drugs though is people using them for unhealthy reasons.
Yeah. Now, I'm intrigued by your mention of, I think you use the term nutraceuticals, and I've been doing a series on nutrition and mental health. So I'm curious about if you could say more about the use of food in the treatment of ADHD.
So when people talk about food and ADHD, the older story about this was, for example, the Feingold diet, that there'd be something in foods that were causing a problem, in this case sugar, and if you eliminate sugar, perhaps people or kids in that case would have less ADHD. The more modern version of that story is, what about all these additives that people are taking? And, you know, there's certainly data that if you give kids sugar, if you give kids additives, you probably are going to have bad behavior or worse behavior. That's different than saying that it's causing ADHD. And there's no data that I've seen or know of, at least, that suggests clearly that it's a food-based or an additive-based problem, but that's not the reason for the problem. On the other hand, it'd be very prudent, I think, for people to, on an individual basis, understand what are the best foods for them. And one very common phenomenon recently has been people identifying gluten sensitivity, for example, and finding that if they cut out gluten that they feel better. What I've seen with some patients, for example, is that they just have more energy to get through the day and to cope with their ADHD challenges. You know, I haven't seen someone where it reversed their core ADHD, you know, sort of traits, but maybe make things easier for them. The idea of using food-based interventions is very appealing, but we need a lot more science on this as well. And one area that I'm interested in, for example, and pursuing is looking at something like methylfolate, which is an agent which, you know, I'm not recommending to people yet, but seems to augment antidepressant therapy for some people with depression on an antidepressant. So the question would be, if you give the same agent, which is part of a cycle of chemistry that produces some of these same neurotransmitters we've been talking about, dopamine and norepinephrine, would you be able to support people with ADHD better by giving them, you know, enough, you know, basically folic acid in the right form for it to get to their brains? There also are a number of other sort of just compounds that are worth exploring, because when you give them to rats, and if you look at the density of the synapses in the rats, they, you know, the rats function better, and you see perhaps, you know, new synapses being formed. We don't really know how this translates into meaningful adult interventions. There's a myriad theories about tweaking different biochemical pathways to the advantage of the brain and brain functioning that really don't hold up when you actually look at, for example, things like, okay, they say that this is going to help my brain on the label, but, you know, how much is actually getting to my brain after it's digested by the enzymes in my body? You know, we don't know, or in fact, it could be very little in some cases of things that are touted to be helpful. So, you know, my model has always been systematic, placebo-controlled study of things. And I think it's very interesting that we have some possible candidates, but I'm far from actually recommending this. And I do think, though, that over the long term, we may have some, you know, idea of what is sort of brain sort of learning promoting, so to speak, that learning in the brain is rewiring. So can you promote sort of the optimal conditions for forming new synapses, for example? And can you give somebody a chance to practice new habits that would be really key to a more organized life while they're, you know, receiving, you know, some kind of nutraceutical or medical food support? You know, like, are they more likely to learn under these sort of, you know, optimal, you know, brain nutrition conditions? I think that's the kind of space that I would like to see things move towards.
Yeah, well, currently, are you in a minority with this nutraceutical vision, or is the pendulum swinging, or has it swung more in that direction?
Well, there's more science now, you know, to really sort of understand, I think, you know, how compounds get into the brain, how they fit into biochemical pathways, and to actually, you know, produce them. And then to distribute them. And so there's actually the know-how and a market for this. I think I'm in a minority in terms of, people actively, researching the area, but it is of growing interest across medicine. And I think one of the, more common agents the listeners may have heard of would be, omega-3 fatty acids. And there's been tons of research on omega-3 fatty acids. And, some of that research has focused on things like mood regulation. And some of it has focused on things like, ADHD. Can you improve ADHD by supporting the myelination of the brain or things like this? And, it's actually sort of mixed results. It depends upon what study and what kind of version of omega-3s people are taking. But I think there are many people very interested in this.
Earlier you mentioned gluten, and I've been struck by it. It seems like we're in a gluten bubble or a gluten fad. I mean, never heard of gluten, a few years ago. And now everybody is taking non-gluten things and saying they have a gluten allergy. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on. I would say that definitely humans are into fads. I think that it's why it's so important to have placebo-controlled studies, especially for things that might have risk or, it's a different form of risk, but be expensive. And there's a slew of recommendations for retraining your brain or taking this nutritional supplement or that. And, I really think consumers, and something we try to put in the book is, are best suited if they know what the evidence is for something. And that said, I'm not against a low-risk, low-cost placebo, if that's what it is, I think that there's an interesting limited data, for example, just to take the gluten story, on weight. And how actually, because of what kind of foods people end up eating if they have gluten-free diets, some people actually gain weight, as opposed to necessarily being globally more healthy. And so, people can take things too far. And I think it's really important that people ground themselves in an approach that is the best evidence-based approach, if it's appropriate. And I say that because I think there's some kinds of supports that will never have a good control and never have a good placebo-controlled format that they can actually even be studied in.
And yes, and I recently interviewed somebody who's written a book on placebos, and it turns out that the whole issue of what's a placebo and placebo control is a lot more complex than I realized. And one of the issues, too, that I think you already alluded to is that biochemistry can be so individual that different approaches or biochemical or nutritional interventions might actually have an impact on one person but not across a large population.
Right. So I'm very interested in the personalization of supports. And in the course I teach at APA, American Psychiatric, about ADHD, the point is to bring people the research data, but also how is it obtained and how applicable, how generalizable is it to the general public? And so I think it's similar to what you're pointing out, that research sort of generates, shows you what's true on average, but nobody's average.
Right, exactly.
So you have to take it with a grain of salt, and I have had so many people come in and say, well, I tried medicine for ADD and it didn't work. I said, well, what did you try? Well, I tried this one thing my doctor was comfortable with. I'm like, okay, well, like, why do you think that one thing would work when there's so many other things you could try too? It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming back, I guess, a bit to ADHD, is there a single ADHD entity, or is it really more of a grouping with many different versions of the disorder?
It holds together in terms of impact in life and to some degree inheritance, and also in terms of what treats it. But there are radically different elements to it. impulsivity versus, say, focus versus, say, you know, behavior control. So it's very heterogeneous in terms of how the pattern of symptoms for any individual. But the idea is that the symptoms, even though they're in different patterns, these sort of all should be grouped under one category.
Okay, so it's not like autism where they talk about it being a spectrum disorder.
Well, I think it'd be reasonable to think about many things as a spectrum. I mean, ADHD is a syndrome which sort of has multiple different manifestations is the way that I think about it. And, you know, you can have a spectrum in the sense that you have different doses of it. But, you know, I have people who, you know, for example, are very impulsive, and then people who are not impulsive at all are more towards obsessive, and they both are in ADHD category, and I'm giving them the same medicine. It's very interesting.
Yeah, you've mentioned impulsivity, and it's part of that acronym in Fast Minds. I don't think I had previously associated impulsivity with ADHD. How does impulsivity manifest in adults with this disorder, and what sorts of complications does it lead to in their lives?
So impulsivity is probably the most important sort of trait if it's present, because it's where the most damage can be done. It just takes, you know, one email to your boss when you're frustrated to get fired.
Right.
A few too many comments to your spouse to really do some serious collateral damage. And so impulsive speaking has made its way into the DSM notion of ADHD, interrupting, for example, and also patience in lines, like waiting, trouble waiting. Those are the two main things that have shown up. But acting without thinking is an older symptom that's not really in the current notion of DSM ADHD. In the whole development of DSM-5, there's a strong push by some researchers and clinicians to try to balance out the lack of impulsivity traits. And it didn't end up happening. For example, you have impulsive hyperactive subtype of ADHD. Only three of the symptoms are impulsive. The other six are more hyperactive and restless. On the go, driven by a motor, can't sit still, that kind of thing. And so this imbalance, people thought, should be evened out. Maybe we need another six symptoms of impulsivity. It's such a big deal in these people's lives. And, you know, the committee decided there really wasn't enough data to support that, that it wouldn't be a different condition if you did that. And also impulsivity is one of these dimensional things that cuts across lots of different conditions. So why should it really factor with these other traits and hold together as a member of a flock, so to speak, of symptoms in the syndrome? And so, you know, the academics will keep going on this stuff, and it may not really ever have a nice, neat home in DSM. But, you know, I'll tell you, impulsivity is a major factor in the suffering of many people.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your work with ADHD people, you stress accountability. What can you tell us about that? What is it that they need to be accountable for, and why?
Well, I think people tend to engage in things that are interesting and meaningful to them. And there's a subset of stuff that's just challenging and hard. And for an ADHD individual, that's often things where they have to be still for a long period of time, or they have to, you know, pay attention to things that are not quite scintillating. They're kind of boring and tedious. This is really where you see the challenges. And anybody gets bored in one way or another and has a trouble with focus or follow through in those circumstances. The issue is that it's just that much more often in folks with ADHD. It's much more common and much more of a burden. And so I think you can look at, in the big picture, a pattern of life where people are thriving and fulfilling themselves and doing what they, you know, really want to do and being healthy, or where they're not able to follow through on all those key aspects of life. And sometimes what you need is to make it shinier, make it more interesting. So I use the gym example a lot, but, you know, getting to the gym, you know, having someone who, you know, comes with you is going to be a lot easier to get there, perhaps. You've got a meeting to go to. Well, if someone comes by and recommends and reminds you, you know, here we've got a meeting, you know, then it might fire you up to do it. Doing a project, you know, if you've got deadlines and other people are relying on you and you're a people person, it's going to help. So these are all different kinds of accountability. And I think a lot of in the book, what we're trying to do is help people pick habits that are going to help them thrive. And we know that people already know a bunch of these habits. What they don't know is how to be consistent about them. So when I get the mail, I should throw out the junk mail right away. That could actually be really a nice thing. You have much less stuff on your desk, for example. So whatever the habit is, it might be when I get home, I'm going to get ready for bed as soon as possible, right after dinner, because I know I get tired and then I start watching TV, and those shows that I need to DVR my shows. And not let myself watch TV. So what's the critical moment? What's the critical habit that you're not following through on? And then the question is, what do you follow through on, and what makes that happen? Is it something like what I was mentioning, these interpersonal factors? Can you team up with somebody? Can you, challenge yourself? So these are the different kinds of accountability we want people to brainstorm. And I don't really think it's reasonable to ever say that there's just three ways to have a more organized life, or that people can run like robots and, hit everything in stride. But we do think people can pick their battles so that the things that are most meaningful are tended to.
Well, you've been very generous with your information and your time, and we're probably at a place where we should wrap it up. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think you can get great information from chad.org, which is a very well-managed sort of website. It has good information about attention deficit disorder.
How do you spell that?
chadd.org.
Okay.
Otherwise, we've spent a couple of years working on Fast Minds, How to Thrive if you have ADHD or think you might, and hope that that's a useful resource for people as well.
Okay, well, Dr. Craig Surman, thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure.
What a privilege to be able to talk to this Harvard Medical School psychiatrist. It's clear that he's able to speak very authoritatively from both a clinical and a research point of view. This was the first opportunity I've had to speak with someone about this very recent news that the National Institutes of Health will no longer be working from the DSM in the research that they sponsor. I learned about this development from a link that my friend Jerry Trumbull, who's frequently been a guest on the show, sent to me. I might go upstream and actually interview someone at the National Institutes of Health to dig further into the implications of this decision. On the other hand, I think that Dr. Surman gave us a good overview in this interview. As you go through the list of factors that are implied by the acronym of FAST Minds, it's really difficult not to recognize yourself. At least that's true for me, and I suspect it will be true for many of you. Just to quickly review them, they are forgetful, achieving below potential, stuck in a rut, time-challenged, motivationally challenged, impulsive, novelty-seeking, distractible, and scattered. Did you recognize yourself in any of these? I'll bet you did. So the real question is, are any of these factors so extreme in your life that they cause real problems for you? I really think I might have benefited from seeing someone like Dr. Surman when I was younger. For example, during my college years, when I really did experience some challenge with focus, anxiety, novelty seeking, and impulsivity. But to tell you the truth, back then I don't think there was anyone around with the sort of expertise that Dr. Surman has today. And now I'm at an age where I think it's too late, which I suppose indicates another one of the factors that he listed, which is stuck in a rut. If you suspect that one or more of these are issues in your own life or in the life of someone close to you, you'll really want to read this book. Don't forget that you can use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar to order this excellent book, the title of which, once again, is Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might.
I have a confession to make. I am a shrink wrap radio addict. That's right. Dr. Dave has me totally hooked. I am devouring episode after episode, so I figured it's only fair to make a donation. And, you know, if you're enjoying these shows too, perhaps you should think about making a donation. Maybe even just a one-off one. Every little bit helps. Go on, you know it'll make you feel good.
Make you feel good indeed. And me too. I'm happy to report that we have two new transcripts on the site. Number 349, Intuition and Dreams with David Sowerby, PhD, transcribed by Gloria Ullman, and number 351, The Placebo Effect with Richard Creighton, MD, also transcribed by Gloria Ullman. Say, Gloria can't do them all. How about volunteering to take on a transcription yourself? It does take a bit of time, but it's very rewarding, and you really get into a favorite episode at a deeper level, or at least that's what I've heard from some of our past volunteer transcriptionists. You know, we have some paid advertisers in the right-hand sidebar, and patronizing them is also a way you can support this show. Perhaps you've heard my two interviews with Whole Psychiatry founder Robert Hedaya, MD, from episodes number 260 and number 348. I've been very impressed by the thorough diagnostic workup he reports doing with each patient, as well as the results that he has reported in our interviews. Here's some of what they say on Dr. Hedaya's Whole Psychiatry website. Why Whole Psychiatry? Patients come from across the country because they want to feel better and get their lives back. They come to us to treat the root cause of their problem as a way of eliminating their symptoms. They prefer not to use medication, but are willing to use it only when it is truly needed, as shown by a thorough workup. They want to avoid the medication merry-go-round of try this or that medication. They want to eliminate or reduce medication side effects so they can enjoy their lives. The site goes on to say that as a patient, you can expect a robust medical workup based on the latest scientific research / practices. A renowned psychiatrist with caring comprehensiveness of a family doctor, a highly trained and experienced adult nurse practitioner, ongoing support from clinicians and staff, easy access to our responsive clinicians, ongoing complimentary educational resources, newsletter and workshop by phone, the latest in medical advances, clinicians who confer with your psychotherapist, a private serene office environment set in a lovely area, the convenience of an in-office phlebotomist and lab, on-time appointments, ease of access to the office via mass transit or car. So if you've got some condition that's limiting your life and you've not been able to resolve it anywhere else, you might want to consider a trip to Silver Spring, Maryland for a workup by Dr. Hedaya. At the very least, you might want to click on the banner ad in our right-hand sidebar to go to his site where you'll find lots of additional information and ideas. And while you're on our right-hand sidebar, please notice two new links to books by our author/interviewees. Notably, the Tarot Activity Book by Andrew Matzner, MSW, and The Placebo Response by Dr. Richard Creighton. Finally, as always, I really want to thank you for being a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and I'm hoping you'll spread the word to bring others into the fold, and I promise that I'll continue to surprise you with abundant and varied content.
Hi, this is Dr. John C. Robinson, author of What Aging Men Want, Homer's Odyssey. It's a Parable of Male Aging, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
By now, I'm sure it will be no surprise to you to learn that Dr. John C. Robinson will be my guest on the next episode, and more about that in a bit. But first, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from longtime listener and supporter, Simon, who writes, "Hi, David. I'm about 60% through the transcript I signed on for. Should be completed in the next week or so." Yay, I'm looking forward to that. It's an important one that he's working on. He goes on to say, "Our maniacal life continues with me being made redundant. Sign of the times. Starting a short contract as a fill-in. Lots of job hunting. I decided to try out hostels instead of hotels as lots of travel involved. with this, not half as bad as I was anticipating, followed by permanent work, moving home back to London, and my wife starting a whole new career being a locum down in Exeter, all at the same time, of course. Now, I had to look up locum. I wasn't familiar with that use of the word. I think it's probably more common in England, but it refers to somebody doing temporary work. In this case, she's working as a temporary therapist. Okay, Simon goes on to write, "Hope all is well with your good self. It's great to know that your formidable canon of interviews is ever expanding, and it certainly enriches my life and helps enormously to understand the context behind many of the things my wife does on a day-to-day basis. She's a generic therapist, which means she has to understand a whole raft of therapeutic approaches that specialist therapists do not, and get paid commensurately less. That's life. Keep up the good work. There are many people out there who sincerely appreciate what you do, a real service to humanity, I say. All the best, Simon." Well, Simon, thank you for that, and hunting for a job is harder than working on a job. I know that to be true. So keep your chin up, and I'm sure something is going to turn up for you. And I'm really looking forward to getting that transcript. And I know what it is for your wife. You've explained she's not a totally degreed and licensed therapist, but a very experienced and talented one. And so it's difficult making her way there. So I wish you both lots of luck with your employment travails. Next, we hear from a clinical psychologist here in the U.S. whose name is Athena. It's always good to hear from a goddess. And she writes, "Hi, David. I'm happy to take this project on." She volunteered to do a transcription of my very important interview with Dr. Porges. She says, "It's good to have a deadline, and I will download the Express Scribe software that I recommended and follow the transcription directions that you sent. I found your podcast by searching for various psychology podcasts. You are a wonderful interviewer, and I've enjoyed several of your recent interviews. I look forward to going back through your archives. I look forward to going back through your archives to hear more. What an extraordinary resource you've created. I'm going to tell colleagues about your podcasts. Yay. Also, you've asked for suggestions of interviewees, and I thought of Dan Weil in Oakland. I'm in a supervision group with him, and he's so bright and compassionate. I think your listeners would appreciate hearing from him. You may be familiar with his books on couples therapy, including After the Fight and After the Honeymoon. I think his observations about varying states of mind are precise and illuminating. John Gottman has called him the best couples therapist alive. Maybe you'd like to interview him. Also, Barbara Fredrickson, positive psychologist researcher at the University of Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, wrote the positivity ratio, which is wonderful. She seems brilliant and gracious from hearing her at Berkeley 2 years ago for a CE class. I'm looking forward to doing the transcription. I so appreciate the work you are doing, bringing all of these wonderful scholars to a wider audience. I always enjoy your personal and professional contributions, insights, and stories as well. Keep up the great work, and I'll make a monetary contribution soon. Best regards, Athena." Well, I wrote back to Athena, and here's what I wrote. "Thanks so much for writing. I meant to reply many days ago, but have been so busy that I didn't get a chance until just now. Also, while I'm thinking of it, you might be interested to know that I will be reading your letter to me on next week's episode," which I'm doing right now. "I hope that will be okay with you," I said. "Thanks for your recommendation of interviewing Dan Weil." And I must say, I had not heard of him or his books. I go on to say, "I'll add it to my already long and growing list of possible interviewees. Speaking of John Gottman, I've been pursuing him off and on for a couple of years. He agreed to be interviewed by me, but then didn't respond to my follow-up emails, or the follow-up to my follow-up emails. Also, your recommendation of Barbara Fredrickson is a good reminder. I don't know if you have yet discovered my whole series on positive psychology. I even have a CE course offering on positive psychology. Barbara Fredrickson is one of the leading lights who I've been missing. And she's been suggested to me before, by the way. So thanks again for your offer to transcribe my interview with Dr. Porges. And let me say also that I'm always very warm to hear from other clinical psychologists, and I really appreciate your offer to share Shrink Wrap Radio with your colleagues. Okay, here's one more from Louise in Australia, who writes, "Hey, Dr. D, I have been enjoying the latest post about placebo. It's something I am quite interested in, actually. When I hear people say, oh, that's just a placebo, I feel somewhat outraged. The mechanisms of how placebo works is a wonder and a mystery, and just because you have a name for it does not mean it can be so easily dismissed. I've started listening to this podcast a couple nights in a row, and I keep falling asleep halfway through. Since it's now 3 a.m. and I'm dealing with some 205 psychological questionnaire trauma stirring induced insomnia, I will probably finish the episode now. While I'm touching base with you, and you are kind of my favorite psychological pen pal, I will tell you that the ADHD medication, Strattera, seems to be going well. It was causing a bit of insomnia at first, but overall, even after just a week and a bit of taking it, I am feeling more focused and less impulsive in general. Fingers crossed it will keep working and help me turn my cognitive lemons into lemonade and bring on the post-traumatic growth. I'm still seeing a zillion therapists, and I have just added another to the mix, if you can believe it. I've had my first session with a master's student at university who will be doing some cognitive testing on me to see where my strengths and deficits are so that I can have a bit more direction and insight into the makeup of my brain and do some more targeted rehabilitation. I'm still waiting for my Fast Minds book about ADHD to arrive in the post, and I'm really looking forward to listening to the interview you're doing with that author. In Fast Minds, they recommended recognizing your strengths and using them to manage your deficits. It makes sense, really, and I'm looking forward to getting more detailed tools on how to do this. After reading, quote, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain, quote, by the author, otherwise known as The Clock Lady from The Brain Changes Itself, I've been on a quest to harness the power of neuroplasticity to be able to overcome some of the cognitive deficits that I have previously just accepted as my lot in life. This was what led me to seek therapy in the first place and then to your podcast. So there we are. Hooray for science and all its self-transformative goodness it can bring through genuine insight. I'm going to try to find my place in the podcast now and enjoy some more delicious brain food offered up by my BFF Dr. Dave, Nighty Night Lou. Okay, Lou. Well, how synchronistic that I'm reading this letter in the very episode that I have with my interview on adult ADHD, thriving with adult ADHD with Dr. Craig Soorman. And I also saw your post just recently on Facebook that you've received the book. And then I saw that you, I think you also did a post in the comments area on the placebo response interview. So it's great. And boy, you are really tackling your ADHD with a lot of resources and a lot of determination. And I'm always impressed by your brilliance in self-expression. So thanks so much for being my BFF there in Australia. And so I'm going to wrap it up with that for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. As I just did, I left a comment on the interview with Richard Craden about the placebo effect, which Lou was just referring to. So you can check out my comment there. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone. It's been a long time since I've gotten any there. 206-350-9918. So thanks to Craig Surman, MD, for sharing his insights on thriving with adult ADHD with us today. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. John Robinson, who has written a book in which he uses Homer's Odyssey to create a roadmap for aging men. And even if you're not an aging man, I think you'll find useful lessons in what he has to say and in the way that he shows us how to work with an ancient myth. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.